Welcome to Cinema Chop Shop. Watch, chop, retrofit.
Have you ever forgotten to turn off your work alarm when you're on vacation?
Yes.
Isn't that the worst?
The worst is, I think, I would argue that the worst is when you do it at home on the weekend.
I was at home, and it's the weekend. Mm. Not to be confused with the headliner of the concert that Sean went to see this weekend. This is not a comedy gold podcast.
No, this is a movie podcast called Cinema Chop Shop. Thank you for sticking around during our brief hiatus, but we're back. I've got the full Monty with us.
Full Monty. How long has it been?
3 weeks.
3 weeks.
Yeah.
It's been.
So we got Joey.
Hello.
Todd.
Howdy.
Travisito.
I'm here.
The birthday boy.
Well, thank you very much, sir. Thank
Happy
you for remembering.
Birthday. Do you feel older?
Part of the zeitgeist. Yeah, I 44th lap around the sun, guys.
And I am your so-called host, Sean. So we're back and we are going to be doing a fun episode tonight. Can't believe this is the first time we thought about doing this.
It's retarded.
We are doing the Razzies.
Hmm.
This is the only context where you can use the R word twice.
Yep. Based on the Golden Raspberry Awards, founded in 1980.
Yeah, I'm surprised that it wasn't earlier.
It seems like it's a much longer fixture, but yes, it was co-founded by two UCLA grads, John J.B. Wilson and Mo Murphy. The first awards were held March 31st, 1981, opposite the Oscars, and I think it was held in like one of their houses. So it was kind of had meager beginnings, but now it's kind of become this cultural institution.
I have to say that Mo Murphy is a much funnier name than the other one.
Yeah. Yeah. John J.B. Wilson. To date, Sylvester Stallone is the most awarded Golden Raspberry recipient with.
Did he get one for Fist?
With 12. He has 12.
Holy shit.
So use that in trivia.
Nominations or wins?
Wins.
What was the arm wrestling movie? Which one is that?
Over the Top. Over the Top.
That was surely one of them, right?
It's when I turn my head around the back like this.
Yeah.
Good.
That was it.
It's fucking good.
That's
dude.
That movie. So tonight we're going to talk about the facets of the Golden Raspberries, because a lot of times they get maligned because it seems like they're kind of picking on people.
It's satirical.
Well, but at the same time, they do tend to have a type. Because there are certainly terrible movies out there that they don't even talk about, but they really tend to gear up them, you know, gear up for movies that are bad with pretty heavy hitters in the cast or in the directing or things like that.
Well, they had to apologize for one of those recently when Bruce Willis kept getting nominated for some of the movies that he was doing. And it turned out that he had a
dementia, or what do they call it?
It was like a body dementia thing.
Aphasia,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
So yeah,
so they had to apologize for picking on.
So they are, I guess you could say that they are kind of controversial in those regards. We're going to talk about the two sides of this. Sometimes those movies that win the Picture of the Year awards,
the worst picture,
are deserving, and there's no arguing that they're deserving of ridicule. Whether or not they are truly the worst of the year, that's debatable, but. We're also going to be talking about those films that might have been unfairly judged at the time that have kind of regained some acclaim over the years, and like a fine wine, aged to perfection.
So it's unfairly judged and
deservedly so.
Deservedly so. Okay.
So we're going to start with the unfairly judged.
Okay.
Mine is going to be somewhat controversial because this is a very rabid fan base I'm speaking to. Of course, I'm talking about 1989 Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. Now, I'm not going to argue that this is a great film, but I am going to argue that it is undeserving of the Razzie for a couple of different reasons. So just so we are on the same page. This is the fifth installment in the Star Trek Now movie franchise. It was famously the first one helmed by William Shatner himself, who, according to Screen Rant, it turns out that he acquired the director's chair through a bizarre contract agreement that existed between Leonard Nimoy and himself for decades. I'll paraphrase the rest.
Leonard Nimoy directed either the one before or after, right?
He directed, I believe, Star Trek 2 and 4, both of which are linchpins of the franchise and widely considered by fans and movie critics alike to be the best in the franchise. He had it put into his contract in the 60s that any, basically he called it a favored nations clause, where anything that Leonard Nimoy was entitled to, he was entitled to. So when Nimoy didn't want to direct the fifth movie, basically there's William Shatner forced the studio to hand the keys to the franchise to Captain Kirk.
It's like a first right of refusal.
His, in some ways, this is his Blackbird. And I'm going to argue that the next film I'm going to talk about is someone else's Blackbird. This is a film which came out the same year. It was called The Summer of the Sequels. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade came out that year. Ghostbusters 2, Batman, all of which trounced this movie in the box office. Star Trek rolls into the audiences with a story about a messianic Vulcan who kidnaps the Enterprise and takes it to meet what he believes to be God in the center of the universe, trapped behind an energy barrier, and oh yeah, there's a Klingon ship on their tail. This one almost killed the franchise, and it is not good. There's a rock climbing scene at the beginning of it, which is William Shatner's vanity project. He's free climbing all the way up a rock wall, nearly falls off and dies, but Spock saves him with gravity boots.
Did he also really fall off and die almost?
No, it's bad. It's just the way it's filmed is awful. That it's a terrible, terrible scene.
So it's a 21% Rotten Tomatoes. Tell us why it's undeserving of its award.
Why are the 1/5 correct?
Well, it is. I'm not going to argue that it's a good film. It is. It has its problems. The execution levels are very, very low. The production levels are low. It sounds awful. Sean would have a heart attack watching this movie because it sounds terrible. But this is what I'm going to argue. It is quintessential Star Trek.
Okay, you have to see
it. In the hands of someone else, this would have been a good film because this is the most Star Trek thing that Star Trek has ever done, confronting God.
Okay.
Turns out it's not God, spoiler alert, but probably the purest evocation of Star Trek's like humanist manifesto, if you will, that has ever been put to film. Too bad it's not a better movie. Maybe in the end this is one that's for the fans, and they trotted it out as a summer blockbuster hoping to get wider appeal, and it just didn't work. But I'm going to argue that looked at from the right direction, it does not deserve its Razzie.
Okay. All right, Todd, you're up, bud.
All right. So one of the most reviled films of the last 30 years, but which has gotten a bit of a revisiting from
critics. Wait, is that the title? It's
alike.
A long title.
Yeah, it is. That's part of the reason why I got nominated. Paul Verhoeven's 1995 erotic thriller, Showgirls.
Love it.
Yes.
I have a whole story about crashing my car trying to go rent this at Blockbuster.
Yes, you've told the story, yeah.
On this show.
Well, so the first time, I guess I should tell my first time seeing it story. So people in the streaming era won't understand this, but back in the day, if you didn't subscribe to a channel on your cable, it was scrambled, right? So, but the cable that my parents had, the Showtime channel, the scrambling was actually pretty bad. You could put it on there and there was like a line at the bottom of the screen, but otherwise you could see it pretty well.
You had no descrambler?
You didn't need one. I didn't have the gadgets, no. I had friends who had the sort of, you know, illegal gadgets and whatnot, but I didn't have them. But for Showtime, I didn't have to have it because, again, the only the line across the bottom of the screen. Anyway,
most of the scrambling wasn't at titty level, I'm assuming.
Oh, it was at the bottom. You could see. Right, oh, you got the full frontal stuff.
It
was probably my first encounter with what I would have thought of as porn, I guess, because of the full frontal.
Really?
Yeah, I get.
I forgot you were racing nickels.
Right. I didn't get hold of a porn for a while, but yeah, you know, we had.
What
the
about that one
then,
time you were in the woods and you found that hollowed out tree with a bunch of porno mags?
I don't think that was me, but
that was my uncle's deer stand for me.
Okay,
nice.
Everybody has that.
No,
story.
Everybody in my family was too pure. I didn't have the uncle with the hollowed out tree stand.
All right, so Showgirls,
anyway,
back on track.
Sorry. Okay, so in any case, Showgirls. At that age with the scrambled TV, it was just a masturbatory material, let's be honest. Mm-hmm. However, if we look at that movie through a more sophisticated lens. And I think the key to understanding this film that people missed at the time was they didn't think enough about the director's oeuvre in total. So it was building off of Basic Instinct, which Paul Verhoeven had done a few years earlier, which was pretty much, it wasn't really satirical. It was pretty much a straightforward erotic thriller. And that's what people were kind of expecting with Showgirls.
And a masterpiece.
Yeah. It is. It's a really good movie.
It's a masturbatory piece.
Yeah. I would argue, though, that there actually is a little bit of satire in Basic Instinct when you think about the ending with the Janine Triplehorn angle. That was kind of silly and B-movie-ish, and I think intentionally so. But in any case, Paul Verhoeven's two movies in particular that I think we have to consider is 1987's RoboCop, which Paul Verhoeven did, and 1990's Total Recall, both of which are science fiction films, but that have a very heavy social satire element to them. They are not... You're not supposed to take these movies tonally at face value. You're supposed to understand them within a context of satire. And I think that is what people have missed with Showgirls, Travis.
Sharon Stone is also in Total Recall.
Yes.
And she shows her boobies.
Interestingly, Sharon Stone was one of the people considered for the role that Gina Gershon ended up playing in Showgirls. The people that they consider for some of these roles is kind of interesting. For the Elizabeth Berkley, a.k.a. Jesse Spano from Saved by the Bell, for that role they considered Pamela Anderson, Jenny McCarthy, and a few other people of that ilk. So they weren't trying to come up with like heavy bangers for this. Paul Verhoeven later said that the reason he went with Elizabeth Berkley was because they needed someone who could dance and who was fine with being fully frontal nude. Which was a small group.
How
of
did he know she could dance?
I guess they, you know.
She didn't dance on Saved by the Bell,
yeah,
did
she? Did. I'm sure they did.
You don't
dance.
Remember the episode? Excited. I'm so excited. And yeah. I just can't.
I think that it would be disingenuous to go any further without disclosing for the folks at home that Todd is a Saved by the Bell Uber fan.
Oh, wow.
So
this is
the idea
Tremors?
Of Jesse swinging around that pole has a lot of sway over his. Yeah.
I'm so excited and I can't deny it. In any case, in terms
Got
of the quality of the film and why it's misunderstood, that satirical element I think is what a lot of people missed with it initially. If you watch that movie, it's supposed to be excessive. That's the thing that the critics panned it for. It's supposed to be excessive. It's supposed
like a soap
to be
opera.
Silly. The soundtrack, Verhoeven has talked about that before the movie was even made, that the person he picked for that from Depeche Mode, I can't remember the guy's name, but he wanted
Mr. Mode.
He wanted him to do an excessive, silly sort of soundtrack. First off, because that's how it is in Vegas. But second, because that was kind of the tone he was trying to set. Now, there were some missteps for sure. So I'm not claiming it's a perfect movie. The infamous rape
whoa,
scene.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. You already said it's a perfect movie. You claimed it.
Oh, okay.
We had it notarized.
Here, let me do the playback.
The infamous rape scene, I think, kind of ruins the tone part. Everyone involved with that movie has admitted that that was a horrible mistake. From Verhoeven to the screenwriter, who says he was going through a divorce at the time, and that was why it was so dark. It was the same guy, I can't remember his name, but the same guy who scripted Basic Instinct. The actress says it traumatized her, that you know, being in it. Everyone admits that that was a terrible mistake, and I do think that that bomb in the movie probably corrupted the satirical vibe that otherwise was, I think, pretty clearly being set.
I mean, just look at what's his face's Kyle MacLachlan's performance in it. I mean, it's so bad that. It had to be intentional.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because Kyle MacLachlan's a really good actor.
So
the person
MacLachlan
you were thinking
actually
about
has,
was Joe Esterhaus?
Yes, correct.
So MacLachlan actually has spoken about this movie. Even today, he doesn't really acknowledge the satirical moments. I think he's wrong about it. But here's a quote from him. I was absolutely gobsmacked. I said, this is horrible, horrible. And it's a very slow sinking feeling when you're watching the movie and the first scene comes out and you're like, oh, that's really bad. But you say, well, that's okay. The next one will be better. And you try to convince yourself that it's going to get better and it just gets worse. And I was like, wow, that's crazy. I mean, I really didn't see that coming. So, and he kind of goes on with that, but...
ironically, he did see that coming. And He mispronounced the name of the band Godsmack.
And another thing that kind of hurt the movie's reputation, too, is that some of the people involved with it who knew that they were trying to be satirical kind of undermined that in some of the interviews they did where they were inconsistent with it. And in some cases, they were like, well, that's not what I intended and stuff like that. I think that their own words kind of undermined it. But in any case, I think overall it's become revisited. People love it now. It's one of those movies that has festivals surrounding it, people acting it out like Rocky Horror Picture Show, that sort of thing.
People really need shit to do, don't they?
Yeah.
I think the past tense of undermined is undermound.
I'm sure I said the wrong word. I said undermined. What did I say? Undermined? Whatever.
All right. So a nice assessment.
Okay.
I think you're right. I think that the point was missed. And I remember at the time that it was being marketed, you know, so much was centered around Elizabeth Berkley. It's her first big role.
Right.
It's another case of the marketing machine in direct opposition of what the director's vision was, I think. Yep. So, yeah.
And poor Jesse Spano, or Elizabeth Berkley, I should say, her agency immediately dropped her after the film got panned, and no one would hire her. No agency would take her on because of the reputation of this film. And I don't think her performance is that bad, given what she was, the material she was given. So,
all right, Travis, you're up.
Okay, so what I have to tell you guys is that I underwent a revival, an awakening. So I watched both of my movies, and I flip-flopped. I flip-flop you guys.
Oh, wow.
Yes. I'm doing the one that I originally thought was deserving of the title.
Yes.
And it's movie 43.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
Movie 43. Okay, so.
People hate that movie.
They really hate it. And I thought I hated it too. And then I rewatched it. So I also think that
I never saw it.
It's a grower, not a shower. Yeah.
So many people hate it. I was like, I'm not going to bother with it. So
tell us.
I think I might have been conflating it with Tim and Eric's $1 billion movie.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is terrible unless I rewatch it and think it's amazing. So I do have a rundown of movie 43. It came out in 2013, and it's one of those anthology comedies. So you have a wraparound story, and then you have little vignettes, right?
Yeah. 4%!
It's got a 4% on Rotten Tomatoes.
So tell me, how is this thing redeemable?
It's redeemable because I watched it today, and I LOL'd multiple times.
Oh my gosh. It's got a huge cast.
Okay, so the cast. Well, first, let's talk about the directors, because each segment is directed by a different director. We've got Stephen Brill, Peter Farrelly, one of the Farrelly brothers, Will Graham, Steve Carr, Griffin Dunn, Elizabeth Banks, Brett Ratner, James Gunn, Bob Odenkirk.
Oh, my.
All right, and the cast. So we got Elizabeth Banks, Kristen Bell, Halle Berry, Kate Bosworth, Gerard Butler, Josh Duhamel, Anna Faris, Richard Gere, Terrence Howard, Hugh Jackman, Johnny Knoxville, Justin Long, Christopher Mintz-Plasse, Chloe Grace Moretz, Chris Pratt, Liev Schreiber, Emma Stone, Jason Sudeikis, Uma Thurman, Naomi Watts, and Kate Winslet. So, I remember watching this movie, and it's before Letterboxd, so I couldn't go back and look at my review. But I remember thinking, you know what? This is bullshit. And I rewatched it today, and I was like, I'm laughing out loud at every sketch. So it's either.
So the question is, have you evolved or devolved since
I've
your?
I've devolved.
Okay. Is it you who's bullshit?
Because it is made for horny teenage boys. And apparently...
So this is a Benjamin Button situation here. You're okay.
I'm devolving. All right, so...
Much like Todd's movie was made for horny teenage boys and horny old men who uncomfortably watched Saved by the Bell for years until Jesse Spano was legal.
And then had to artify the work thereof. So.
All right, so I got to break down the different segments. The overarching theme is called The Thread. Basically, these dudes upload a video of them playing human darts. One of them has a dartboard on the head. One of them throws a dart. And they make a video of it, upload it to YouTube, and they think it's going viral. Younger brother pops in. He's like, ha, 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 it didn't go viral. I hacked your shit, blah, blah, blah. But they make up a thing to prank him called Movie 43. And that is the wraparound. All right. And
the frame story.
Yes. The framing narrative. Yes. The first one is called The Catch. And it's Kate Winslet and Hugh Jackman. And they're on a blind date. And they walk in. Apparently, he is the real deal. He's a wealthy financier. He is a philanthropist. And he's very charming and good looking. They go into the restaurant. They comment on each other's scarves. He takes off his scarf and he's got a dangling pair of testicles from his neck.
Oh, I've seen this. Okay. Yes. I've seen this movie. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Dangling pair of testicles.
Yeah.
And so throughout the whole segment, she's grossly aware of this and nobody else wants to comment on it. So that's really funny. He holds a baby. The balls are on its forehead. It's terrible. Then we've got Homeschooled, directed by Will Graham. This one stars Jeremy Allen White from The Bear and
Iron Claw.
And what's that show?
He's soon to be Bruce Springsteen.
No, but the show.
It's the series that he was in with James H. Macy.
So it's called this segment is called Homeschooled, where he's a homeschooled kid. And the parents, played by Liv Schreiber and Naomi Watts, are sitting down explaining to their new neighbors about how they homeschool their son, Jeremy Allen White. And at first it starts out really cool, but then they move on to tell him how she still breastfeeds him and they bully him because that's what he would experience in high school. And he has his first kiss with his mom. It's really fucked up. All right. Then we go to, oh God, this one's terrible. The Proposition. Yeah. The Proposition, not The Proposal, but it is a proposal. We've got Chris Pratt and Anna Faris who were actually married at the time of this filming. They're at a picnic and he's getting ready to propose. He's got the ring in his pocket and he's like, I've got something to ask you. And she's like, I've got something to ask you. And he's like, well, why don't we say it at the same time? And they're like, 3, 2. And she's like, I want you to poop on me. And he's like, what? Wait, what did you say? And so she really wants him to poop on her. And so he like gets advice from his friends. JB Smoove is one of them. And it turns out that she does want him to poop on her, but she wants it to be like romantic and drawn out. And he's ready to go. And she's like, wait, no. And then he eventually like explosively shits all over the neighborhood. And she's like, of course I say yes. All right, next we got.
So wait, so totally far you haven't said divorced, the so. Only words that you've used to describe every one of the vignettes is it's so terrible.
They're awful.
But yeah, and all, words like terrible and awful, but yet you're going to argue
found myself
that it is
laughing
the redemptive
out
one.
Loud okay. at each.
I think I'm agreeing in Joey's assessment that you might have devolved.
Yeah. All right. Next we've got Veronica, starring Kieran Culkin and Emma Stone. All right. So Kieran Culkin is the cashier at a regular grocery store. And his ex, Emma Stone, walks in. And they just start talking mad shit to each other. And it's really, really like vitriolic. They are going at like the core of what will make each other just fume. And then she walks out and the rest of the people in the grocery store, because they've heard him talking on the intercom, they decide to cover his shift so he can go after her. All right, we got a couple more. Next one's iBabe. iBabe. So this is a like an iPod that you can listen to music on, except it looks exactly like a naked hot chick that you listen to music on. And the problem is that there's a vent port that's placed in the lower region that stupid horny teenage boys keep trying to fuck and mangling their penises. All right, next up. That one stars Richard Gere, Kate Bosworth, Jack McBrayer. Next up, superhero speed dating. All right, so we got Robin, played by Justin Long, is playing Robin, all right? He's trying his best to do a speed dating. And then guess who plays Batman, who just keeps popping in and ruining everything? Jason Sudeikis. Mm. And Uma Thurman plays Lois Lane. Bobby Cannavale plays Superman. Kristen Bell plays Supergirl. John Hodgman as the Penguin. Anyway, I ended up loving this comedic anthology movie.
Loving.
I loved it. And I flip-flopped. This is the one that was unfairly judged, you guys.
Okay. Thank you for that thorough...
There's a lot more. I could go on.
Well, thank you for editing yourself.
There's this one at the end where there's an animated
the special
cat.
Features, he goes through all 43 of them.
Josh Duhamel and Julie Bowen.
Yeah. You got to save something for the cat. Patreon subscribers.
Yeah, the Patreon subscribers get to hear all the other stuff. Well, now I don't have to see the movie. So thank you for that.
I really get the feeling that I was more entertained by your recap of the movie than I would have been by the movie.
You need to watch it.
Except I kind of want to see, and I don't remember, but I've seen that one skit, but I do want to see.
Oh, there's a whole other one with Halle Berry and Truth or Dare where she makes guacamole with her boob.
But you're going to have to pay to hear that one, folks.
Wow. All right.
That was pretty much the whole
thing. In the interest of time, I'll be brief with mine. I picked the second winner of the Golden Razzie, and that would be Mommy Dearest from 1981.
Now, we've talked about this.
We have on the podcast.
Don't use metal hangers.
No wire hangers ever. This movie terrified me as a child. It's got a 48% on Rotten Tomatoes, starring Faye Dunaway as Joan Crawford and Diana Scarwood as Christina Crawford.
Now, was it specifically spelled out that that was a representation of them?
It was from Christina Crawford's point of view.
Okay,
and
gotcha.
It was based on her book, not her life with her mother.
Gotcha. Yeah. Right, gotcha.
I think this film kind of set the tone for Lifetime movies. Very opinionated, very very much from one person's point of view. And that's been one of the knocks on the book itself, was that maybe she took some liberties with what actually happened. However, it made for a very fun, melodramatic, soap opera kind of film. And it's definitely a masterclass in passive-aggressive behavior and then these flare-ups that Joan Crawford would supposedly have with her daughter. The movie does present this strange dichotomy really of like Joan Crawford wanted a family, couldn't have kids, so she adopted children. However, she was in direct competition with her children for attention. Like, she needed to be in the spotlight. Mm-hmm. Whenever her kids would get the spotlight, that's when she would act out.
She went full on dance mom.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The one thing you need to know about this movie is that Dunaway's performance is so incredibly over the top that it saves this movie, but at the same time it slays the movie because it's so ridiculous and silly.
I don't consider this a bad movie.
It's a fun movie.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that it influenced Lifetime movies, which I think you're right about, but it also dovetailed off the hagsploitation era.
Yes.
Oh, sure.
Like, you know, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, and, you know.
Absolutely.
Who Slew Auntie Rue and stuff like that.
I like to think about Lifetime movies on one shoulder as like the angel. No, I'm sorry. Lifetime is the devil. And then Hallmark is the other shoulder as the angel. So it's Hallmark, Lifetime on the little shoulders.
We'll all marry a prince and we'll get to live in a castle and be
in
wealthy.
Ireland.
In Ireland, of course. And yes. And then, of course, Lifetime will tell us that the bed will be turned set on fire and then the husband will beat the hell out of us. Yes. So anyway, that was my redemptive movie. I think that Mommy Dearest, even, I mean, at a 48%, it is kind of an obvious one. It's probably one of the highest ranked Razzie Award winners.
I was shocked to see this one on the list when we were doing, because I remember seeing it and I didn't have real strong feelings about it either way, but it didn't strike me as a terribly bad movie.
Agreed.
And I remember it was kind of over the top, but the scene at the end where, near the end, where Joan Crawford gets to be a stand-in on a soap opera is kind of poignant. Like, she's like, I'm back in, you know, she's back in the spotlight.
I'm back, baby.
Yeah, yeah.
But so, she's also aging starlet. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if it had to do with the controversy, too, because, you know, the other children, the siblings of the person mm-hmm. who wrote Mommy Dearest, pretty much to a person said this wasn't true. And which created like a lot of controversy. I don't know. Maybe,
she must not have beat their ass with a wire hanger then.
I'll end on one note, by the way. Small world. Diana Scarwood, who played Christina Crawford, she starred in a commercial for a meatpacking company that made hot dogs and cocktail
was
weenies.
Was it the same one that Rocky called, wore to the, no, the meatpacking
it's called, plant? It was called Brian Foods out of West Point, Mississippi. I worked at Brian Foods out of college. So
no, you did not.
Small world.
You were doing college radio and working for this food company?
No. After college, my second job as a designer was for this company, and so she and I have that in common.
That's pretty awesome.
Yes. And Todd needs to go pee in the yard, so that's a perfect opportunity for us to say,
let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
And get ourselves some raspberry tart.
Nice.
Yum, yum. It's time for a tasty and refreshing snack. We promise to satisfy your hunger, your thirst, your sweet tooth. So visit our refreshment center now. Let's go.
We're back. Some of us peed in the yard. Some of us did not. Some of us
I did.
Yeah.
I peed out there.
The one who's not drinking did not.
I did not pee in the yard. This kombucha is not going right through me. Yeah.
All right. So what do we like to do when we come back from break?
Shake each other's hands and look each other in the eye and say, it's time for a beer check-in.
All right. Well, I sent out a challenge and some of you remembered and some of you did not.
I did not.
I said, let's drink our least favorite beers. I chose Blue Moon. I think Blue Moon's a terrible beer, and I've been drinking that.
And we all disagree to drink it.
And Todd is a flawed human being. So I did bring an on-theme beer. It's from Prairie Artisan Ales out of Oklahoma. It is called Razzle Dazzle.
Razzle Dazzle, as in
there
the
was
Razzies.
Actually a there was a club in the country town Nichols that I lived in called the Razzle Dazzle. Back in the day.
And what kind of club would this be?
Redneck would be the genre.
Okay.
And they would let underage people go in, boot and scoot and boogie in and all that good stuff. Yep, that's it.
So this is a barrel-aged stout with toasted caramel, raspberry, and toasted marshmallow flavor.
And it is very tasty, and I'm feeling like at least 8%.
I was gonna say you could probably get me in trouble with this if you just gave it to me. I might not recognize it as beer.
Yeah,
it doesn't have the strong aftertaste that most barrel aged beers of this sort have.
All right, so
where are we at on ABV?
So we're gonna play a game. Everybody's had a little taste. Guess mm-hmm. the ABV.
I'm going 9%.
I'll say 9.5.
What is the ABV of cough syrup?
I don't know.
I'm going to say it's equal to that.
13%.
Whew.
13.
So be careful.
So who wins
so
based off
because
the
I'm the only one the price who is right. named?
The Price is Right standard.
This
what
tastes
is,
like one of those.
Oh, you got it. You got
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah.
This tastes like one of those chocolates with like the liquid filling yeah, on the inside.
Yeah. Liqueur.
It's really not. All right. So we got some ground to make up since we had some exhaustive explanations. So, we're going to jump right into the back half of our...
Are you talking about my description of movie 43?
Not at all. Our very deserving of the your glasses are up there, sir.
Okay, the viewers at home,
this is not a visual medium. I've got
Joey's
got
to get his reading glasses.
This is what I just saw. I saw Joey scrambling for his glasses and pulled out a pair of sunglasses and put them on before taking them off.
That's the most amazing thing.
Realizing that I had
my
reading glasses on my top of my head. Yes. And I'm not drinking tonight.
Invoking my grandmother, both in terms of forgetting and style.
I love it.
This 13% really went to my head. This like a little this sip.
The thimbleful. All right, JoJo, what have you got as your deserving Razzie?
Okay. Before I get into this, I just want to say that Prince, the artist formerly known as the late Prince, is a demigod among men. I mean, no disrespect to Prince as a human being or to his legacy. I apologize to Prince wherever he is on the astral plane.
Wait, is demigod bad?
No, it's just sort of a half god, half man thing. Okay. A god among men, if you will. The movie that I'm reviewing and that I'm going to argue is deserving of its Razzie is Prince's directorial debut, 1986's Under the Cherry Moon.
Under the Cherry Moon.
Now, if you have never seen this film or heard much about this film, which I hadn't until yesterday, you might think it's something very much different than it is. This is Prince's homage to 1930s golden era Hollywood screwball comedies.
Okay. I would have never have thought. So, you know, Prince sees himself as Gary Cooper, as that ilk of...
That's very much how this comes off. And he pulls it off, if you could imagine Gary Cooper prancing around set with, you know, spangly matador outfit on in for the entire movie. Yes.
Putting on the Ritz? Is he putting on the Ritz?
He is putting on the Ritz, yeah. So, you know, again, Prince, if you think Prince is just a pop star, he's not. You're wrong. Prince could wail on every instrument in his band. He was a consummate band leader, a hit maker. So was a directorial auteur. This movie just is the definition of does not land. So it's very much a screwball comedy. Prince and Jerome Benton play two gigolos from Miami who make their living wooing wealthy women in the south of France. Very much a screwball comedy. Lo and behold, they both fall in love with the same rich heiress. And not giving too much of the story away in case anyone wants to watch it. There's tragic results and there's comic results, but the comic results just aren't funny. And
where does Morris Day come into
this? Morris Day is not actually in this film, but he was along for the ride for the soundtrack, which was released as a Prince album, Paradise.
Okay.
Which is not one of the shining lights in Prince's discography, but is pretty damn good. I think they tried to distance it from the movie by releasing the soundtrack as a separate thing, Paradise.
Separate question. There was a sequel movie to Purple Rain. Was that
Graffiti
Rainbow?
Bridge?
Graffiti Bridge. Okay. Mm-hmm. This is not that movie.
No. Graffiti film. Bridge is almost as bad as this movie, though, but it is not.
Okay.
The only thing I had to say about this movie is that you have to watch it, because here's my experience of watching it. For the first 20, 30 minutes, you're thinking, oh my God, this is just misunderstood. People don't understand that Prince is either lampooning or paying homage to, or both, the screwball genre. But you know, once that, and just the singular weirdness of watching him, as I said, strut around in spangly matador outfits and go through the motions of a second-rate screwball comedy, once that wears off, it becomes very, very, very tedious. And it was hard for me to finish this movie. Ultimately, after the first, you know, 30 minutes and the shock wears off, very little entertainment value. It just doesn't land, and it kind of hurts to, like, watch Prince
make a misstep,
fall to the ground
so
horribly. I mean, like Icarus, he tried
like
to fly.
Icarus, yes.
And just did not.
There you go. You saw
very
this,
good.
This
time.
You watched it on Criterion?
I did. I watched
Criterion
it. Criterion
has
on
a
there.
Razzie's collection, so that's
no
cool.
Shit.
Yeah.
I wanted to like this movie so much. It's Under the Cherry Moon, starring Prince.
It looks cool, though, right?
It looks cool. Apparently, the studio insisted it be shot in color, so they shot it in color and then
converted to black and white.
Yeah, retroactively converted it.
That's weird.
Yeah, and it looks good. And if you know, you had it on in the background, you'd think it was very compelling, but it is just not. Prince is not an actor. He hams it up in every single role. He does have screen presence. You want to watch him. And it's not a complete failure because it's a very singular artistic vision, but
well, this film
not one that has that much merit, really.
This film did have a 35% Rotten Tomatoes, and it shared its Razzie with another film that we'll be hearing about much later. Todd, you're up.
My selection for the deserved film that I just watched yesterday for the first time. Deserved, is that right? Whatever.
You're fine.
Is 2003's Bennifer Effort Geely.
Oh, God.
And so let's,
I've never seen it. Please tell me.
So why awful. So it is awful. It is in the Criterion Razzie collection. And let me start. Let me give you an easy reason why this movie's bad. So the title, first off, Geely. Where the hell did that come from? It is a one-note joke. The title character is Larry Geely, played by Ben Affleck. And at the beginning of the movie, people mispronounce his name as Jiggly or Giggly. And
I thought it was
a few times, and that's why they call it Geely, because people mispronounce his name a couple times. It's so ridiculous, stupid. Now, the guy who wrote and directed this is actually a guy with some chops. His name is Martin Brest. No A in the breast. He's got more than
chops, and you know what I mean?
Yep. So he directed Beverly Hills Cop, the first one, 1984. He did Midnight Run, 1988, with Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin. Wrote and directed that one.
Good movie.
Good movie. He did Scent of a Woman, Hoo-Ha, and Meet Joe Black. So he did all of those movies. So not a guy that was, you know, known for bombs. Apparently, though, he wrote a couple scripts for this, and he said this was one of those cases where the studios got involved, didn't like what they had on film, and interfered, and fucked it up.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I want to point out to the audience that Joey is holding Todd's hand for support.
Okay.
We're playing footsie under the table, too.
Ooh, yeah. Now, you want to talk about box office bombs. Some of them are, you know, a box office bomb is any movie that, of course, just doesn't make money. They spent $7.6 million on Geely. It made $7.2 million at the box office. So that is a bomb among bombs. $7.2 million on a $75.6 million budget is a bomb among bombs.
Yeah. And they marketed the fuck out of it, too, because I remember that.
I mean, that is losing money out your ass. But, okay, so let's talk about why this movie's bad. I'll try not to belabor it too much, because you don't really have to, because this movie's awful. The only person that actually gave this, one of the few people, I should say, that gave this movie a good review was Roger Ebert. And he said that he thought the dialogue was really good. And sorry, Roger, I don't know what you were smoking when you watch this movie. The dialogue is horrific, and one of the reasons why the movie's bad. It's a Chasing Amy sort of premise where J-Lo plays a lesbian.
Which Ben Affleck was also in.
Which Ben Affleck was also in. He's got to convert the lesbian. Of course, a very dated premise.
But a noble challenge that I've completed multiple times.
Not a politically correct premise, nonetheless. And also, so Geely works for this crime boss who asks him to kidnap the mentally challenged kid so that they can hold that kid ransom to, he's the son of a judge, who they want to use in order to get the judge to give them the favorable result they want in a trial for a character played by Al Pacino.
Yeah.
Wah! Hooah. Of course, Martin Brest went back to his friend Al Pacino.
Spelled without an A.
Yeah, and so it's very offensive. The mentally challenged kid loves rap music, so they have him rapping things. Oh, listen to him. He's saying the N-word and all this stuff, and it's like, come on. It's very cringy.
You had me at rap music.
The actor who played the guy didn't do a bad job given what the material he was given, Lenny Venito. You can only work with what you're given, and he did fine given that, but it was very cringy. The Geely J-Lo partnership there, as a lot of critics have pointed out, even though they were actually together in real life, they have no chemistry in the movie. None whatsoever. The jokes all fall flat. None of the characters are likable. It is just a horrific, horrific movie.
Just a train wreck.
And I wonder, too, Martin Brest, I read a few interviews with him. He talks about he had a couple of different scripts, you know, and given the success he had with some of those other movies and the quality of some of them, I wonder, you know, what if they had let him just do what he wanted to do with the movie? Who knows? But in any case, the movie definitely, I mean, and so we've talked on this podcast before about how movies like, let's say, Troll 2 or something like that, yes, they're horrible movies, but they're wildly entertaining. Geely is a truly terrible movie because it's not entertaining. It was a slog to get through.
It's like a husk of a film.
Exactly.
And what did you say the director writer's last name was?
Brest minus the A.
All right, Travis, what you got?
All right, so as I mentioned earlier, I flip-flopped on my two picks.
And you're going to do a movie that we've spoken about before on this very show.
Yes. So originally, for the unfairly judged movie, I picked Howard the Duck. Howard the Duck.
Are you going to go back on that now?
You've turned now.
Yes.
You've turned your back on Leah Thompson.
I rewatched it.
Jesus.
And I did not laugh. I rewatched it. I watched it very closely. I was waiting for the funnies. There were no funnies. I did not laugh. So I am forsaking Howard the Duck on this very podcast.
The best part of that movie
saying that it was fairly judged.
Yeah, the best part of the movie is Leah Thompson in her underwear. That's
it. Yeah, yeah. And there's, you can see Leah Thompson in less. But on various sites on the internet.
But that's it for me. It's like the duck with tits. It tries, makes no sense.
It tries too hard to be a
ducks aren't even 80s mammals, movie. Man.
Right.
If you like her in her underwear, you can see her try to fuck her son in Back to the Future. So
That sounds hot. Exactly.
Hot.
Hot.
So premise of the movie for anybody who does not know.
There's a duck and his name is Howard.
An anthropomorphic duck named Howard.
From another planet.
Who is magnetically pulled to Earth in an attempt to do some science shit. He does not fit in. It's a fish out of water scenario.
Or a duck out of water, as it were.
A duck out of water. And sure, he's cool. He's hip. He's with it. But he does not fit in.
And Ed Rooney is your villain.
Ed Rooney, the principal from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, played by
Jeffrey
Jones,
who is a like bona fide creeper.
Yeah, now he's canceled.
Yes,
he's canceled.
Yes,
he does a full fledged like demonic transformation. It wasn't good.
It's bad, man.
So
it's
real
bad. And so my attachment to this film, the reason that I originally said it was redemptively judged was I love this movie when I was like 8 years old.
But you're not 8 years old anymore. You're 12.
And I also have a solid foundation of cinematic observation.
Like movie 43.
And this film really set George Lucas back. I mean, this was he was a director,
it
right?
It is ILM, all the special effects. Our industrial.
Did he actually direct it, or was it just one of those ones he directed and came up with the story?
No, I think he directed it.
He directed it, and the Industrial Light and Magic, the people behind all of the special effects in Star Wars, made the effects in this. Now, a lot of the special effects in this movie are practical effects, which I respect. But then they do this green screen thing with the Dark Overlord.
Oh, it's terrible.
Oh, it's so bad.
No, the director was a guy named Willard Hayek.
It wasn't directed by... What did Lucas have to do with it then?
He was a producer.
Oh, just producer.
So after... I think after the first Indiana Jones movie, he didn't direct anything.
Because everyone said you shouldn't direct movies.
Until the reboot of Star Wars. Everything after that, he came up with the story ideas for, but he didn't actually direct.
He's a pitch
That's
man.
That's fair.
He's a pitch man. Yeah. So,
more like a bitch man.
Yeah, really.
We got a beer check-in.
I've never felt so empowered.
It is from a local brewery called Wild Heart. They're in Hartsville, South Carolina.
Very good brewery.
And this beer is called Namesake.
I like that one, yeah.
So I've been pronouncing it Namasaki.
Namasaki. Namaste.
That one and the Blue North are fantastic. I just saw it on the shelf, Sycamore Brewery, which I like a lot. They had the Mango Chronic IPA, which they have a spliff on the picture. And they're very well known for... Thank you, sir. Very well known for their imagery on their cans. Pretty good. You have to like it, you know, a little bit of a citrusy taste, but if you like that, it's a good beer.
So you guys get the honor of picking my next review.
Mm-hmm.
You have the choice of Saving Christmas, starring Kirk Cameron,
mm-hmm.
or you have the choice of Battlefield Earth, starring John Travolta.
I want to hear what you have to say about the Kirk Cameron
movie. I heard.
I want to hear what you say about Kirk Cameron. All right,
so I heard that Kirk Cameron had a writer that in that movie he could only kiss his sister.
Pick.
I bet Battlefield Earth.
Pick.
I'm definitely going with the Battlefield Earth.
Excellent. Okay.
Way more amazing.
You bastards.
All right. I will say this about Saving Christmas. Next to Ted Cruz, Kirk Cameron has the most punchable face on Earth.
Yes.
That smug bastard needs my fist.
I come in at number three, and I've never been punched in the face.
I will gladly talk to you about this film off mic. I don't know why y'all don't want to hear the Kirk Cameron review. It's a horrid mess. All right, Battlefield Earth, penned by one L. Ron Hubbard,
mm-hmm.
a.k.a. the father of Scientology.
This came up on trivia.
A.k.a. a crazy
Right Answers with Wrong Travis.
Oh, boy. This film, it comes in with a Rotten Tomatoes rating of 3%.
Three?
Yes.
Holy
shit. I would love to talk to those three people, because this movie... Fucking
from the year 2000...
Each person is not a percent.
From the year 3000.
Totally. This film obviously was a short story. It had to have been a short story because it just doesn't have enough meat to the bone, but it reeks of a nerd writing it. John Travolta and Forrest Whitaker,
yes,
come from the planet Cyclo.
Yes, the Cyclosians.
They are coming to Earth to subjugate the planet. And this is, of course, we join this in progress. They've already subjugated the planet. It has a very Planet of the Apes kind of feel where the humans are very primitive and stupid.
I hope they don't go native.
But I can also tell that there is a nerd narrative involved, because anytime they shoot their laser guns, the lasers don't make a sound because lasers don't carry sound. But on film, it looks like just
pew, 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 pew.
It's just the stupidest fucking thing I've ever seen.
You can see John Travolta, the troops are like, listen, lasers don't make sound, guys. We're not going to do that.
So John Travolta plays one of the Cyclos. And one thing you need to know about them physically is that they have elongated craniums that, for the men, is obscured by their manly dreadlocks. But for the women, they look like really ugly, like oblong, crazy skull caps.
And they're also like, there's a visible ridge.
Okay, I was going to get to that.
Even on the cover of the movie.
I was going to get to that.
That's the racism of Mr.
In film and prosthetics, when you use latex appliances, there's something called blending, where you blend the edges so you don't see the transition from your skin to the plastic. There are scenes when people come walking in looking like they bought something at fucking Spirit Halloween.
Like Coneheads from
SNL.
And
you can seriously see the ridge. Yeah. It's terrible. The other thing you need to know about their race, they're very tall. And to be very tall, they wore like these weird platform stilt shoes, which rendered every single one of them almost immobile. There are chase scenes in this movie. And these guys are like plodding along, and it looks like all you'd have to do is just kind of poke them in the side and they would tip over. Oh my God, this movie is just rife with just shitty, shitty decision making, bad planning, and just all around bad filmmaking.
It was supposed to be, so of course, anybody who knows anything about John Travolta knows that he is a Scientologist. And so the question is, was this just a like his intended vanity project for his Lord and Savior, L. Ron Hubbard?
I think he had to do it.
Yeah. Or did they make him do it?
Well, all right, so here,
and that's another thing. Yeah, they may have forced him to do it.
The other thing about this film is that Travolta's the bad guy. He is the part of the invading alien species, and he's very much painted as a bad guy because he has ulterior motives. The Cyclos have put him on planet Earth on a military deployment, and he's come to the end of it. And he has this very contentious meeting with his superiors. And they say, oh, we've decided to put you in place for another 72 cycles. I mean, whatever the fuck they decide. And he gets pissed off. And so he starts plotting a way to somehow make himself look better and get off the planet. And that is to mine for gold. But not just mine for gold, but to use his underlings, a.k.a. the humans, his slaves, to do the mining for him. Well, these primitive humans need to learn a few skills and trades in order to do the mining. So they teach them, and they find the ones that can actually learn. And then, oh, by the way, this is their insight into Scientology. They pick one of the humans to teach him the cyclo language. They strap him to a chair, very Clockwork Orange style, and he's fed with these three-dimensional words that come flying into his eyes. So apparently you can learn by watching words.
But unlike Clockwork Orange, where that was like supposed to be a terrible thing, this like, oh, this is wonderful.
This guy learns everything. And not only does he learn to read or learn their language, he learns physics, chemistry, biology, mathematics. The guy becomes a genius. And at what point do you, as a criminal mastermind, even in the James Bond universe, stop and say, hey, maybe I shouldn't teach the one guy who hates me the most how to beat me?
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happens in this movie. The subjugated species learns to fly a ship because John Travolta taught him how to. They mine for the gold, but not only are they mining for the gold, but they're also doing an end around where they fly this drop ship that can't go more than 60 miles an hour from Colorado to Fort Knox and steal bars of gold. It's the stupidest, most contrived plot. John Travolta, in the end, ends up getting the short end of the stick. They blow up the Cyclos at their home planet with a nuclear device through a teleportation. It's the stupidest fucking thing I've ever seen. Travis, you've got a question.
I'm just really glad that Sean took the sacrificial momentum and watched this movie for all of us. Because there's no fucking way I'm watching Battlefield Earth.
Well, you know, it's only appropriate that this should come out on Easter weekend because yes, I watched this movie for your sins.
Jesus
Christ. I'm wondering if this movie might have some Plan 9 from Outer Space potential, though. Because the way you were describing it, I thought, well, that might actually be kind of
fun.
Because it is bad.
Geely.
I have seen it. And
so
it's
this
awful.
Is what I talked about with Geely. It didn't have that potential. It was like it was just slog. So what do you say, Sean?
No, it does not. And I'm mocking it, not... I'm really not celebrating the shortcomings of this movie. It's horrible. The whole time you're watching it, you're sitting there thinking,
well,
how
so, so it's not horrible like, oh, ha ha, terrible diet, you know, like Troll 2 or something
it's,
like that.
It's terrible. It is really, really terrible. And yes, it is laughable in how serious it takes itself, but so is Scientology.
Yeah.
And we don't celebrate that.
I was going to say, because Plan 9 from Outer Space also has kind of like an innocence to it, where like this movie, you know,
no, this doesn't with the have whole any innocence.
Scientology thing.
They just knock over
at its,
the...
Yeah. At its core, you know that there are people behind the production of this film thinking that they're smarter than you, and they know better than you, and they're going to give you a product that they can say, oh, look at this, this is our movie. No, you guys really did a shitty movie. It's bad. All right. Let's stick a pin in this one. I think we're done. Travis has that look in his eye like he's about to...
What is that?
Looks like you're about to fall over, baby.
No, not at all. I was going to fight the first one who comes at me.
Birthday boy.
Yeah.
We're going to be back in a couple of weeks. We're going to do one that has an evolution to it. Joey, you recommended an idea to me, and I said, let's pivot this into something else. We're going to do dynamic duo directors. Coen brothers, Wachowski siblings, the Safdies,
Presser and Imberger.
Those
are the guys that did, you know, the
Black Narcissus.
Black Narcissus.
Powell and
Powell and Presser.
Powell and Presser.
One of them's first name is Emerald.
Why did I say Imberger?
I think.
Okay. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Red Shoes.
Red Shoes. All that.
Yeah.
I said the wrong name.
There are some great duo directing teams, and I think we're going to focus on them. So come back in a couple of weeks. We're going to dig deep and come up with some really real winners after we spent all this time talking about the losers. So celebrate the winners next time.
I want to throw in one thing.
Plugs.
While we're talking about bad movies.
Oh, okay.
The new Roadhouse is not that bad.
It's not.
Not that bad?
It isn't. I saw it with him.
Whoa, dude.
I've heard that it was terrible and that what's his face? The UFC
Jake
guy?
Jake Gyllenhaal?
No, the UFC guy.
McGregor.
I didn't like that guy.
He was on meth the whole time. Like, he is like shake-worthy.
Possibly. It's not a great film by any means. Was
neither
I
is the first
neither
Roadhouse.
Neither was the original Roadhouse.
Yeah, don't act
no,
like it's
some untouchable
sacred cow. No,
but the original Roadhouse was
cow.
Almost in a stratosphere of unreality where you had to respect it. Anyway,
I might have to give it a look. So if you want something to do, check us out on Letterboxd. We're doing the Cinema Chop Shop Movie Challenge. I think I'm almost done now. So did you not join up? You need
no.
to get out on that. It's only 52 movies.
I don't care.
You get to watch porn.
I also do watch porn.
Okay, well, you can get credit for it. Please follow us on social media. We're Cinema Chop Shop everywhere except for YouTube, where we are Cinema Chop Shop.
On YouTube.com.
Podcast on YouTube.
Oh, I got a plug.
Go.
I want to plug Waffle House.
Yeah?
Yeah, because I got a great breakfast there this morning.
Good for you.
I will second the motion for Waffle House. I love me some Waffle House.
I just wish they would put their political allegiances elsewhere.
What?
I don't know nothing about that.
Yeah, you do.
I don't
want
to. I will remain blissfully unaware of Waffle House's political allegiances.
I will eat those hash browns.
Eat racist hash browns if I have
to. Those scattered taters. They don't know any political boundaries.
They're smothered.
Smothered, covered. Please come check us out for the next episode, and we hope to see you soon. And we're going to say, please remember to
watch, chop, retrofit.